This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with State Representative Hal Slager, who's a Republican from Schererville, about what is likely to be with the topics coming up at the upcoming General Assembly session that gets underway next month. Also, we'll talk with Jason Gordon, Susan Perry, Richard Maroche, and Valentina Petrushki. All are with Ivy Tech Community College over in Valparaiso about an interesting 3D printer project that was taken on over in Valparaiso for Jay Leno. That and another Lakeshore Focus conversation from Lakeshore PBS. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Won't be long before the General Assembly is back in session in Indianapolis, and let's check in with one of the members of Northwest Indiana's delegation. House Slager is Republican, and he is also represents House District Number 15, which includes the communities of Dyer and Schererville and St. John Township and portions of St. John and Griffith as well, too. Hal, thanks for being with us today here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you.
Well, as we take a look at some of the things that are going to come up here as the 2018 session gets underway, what's your take on what you feel are going to be some of the big issues this time around, since this is the short session, only 30 days altogether in meeting days, and we don't have a state budget we have to put together this time around?
Right. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. The short session was designed to handle the incidentals, and of course we have a fair amount of those where the little repairs needed, the prior bills and whatnot, but it has developed into much more than that, where we end up handling some fairly meaty issues. This year, of course, most people have probably heard there's discussion on putting something in place on how we're going to deal with water infrastructure that is failing throughout the state, so that we don't have a situation like they did in Flint, Michigan. We're trying to get ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably also heard about Sunday sales and liquor. This has been ongoing for years that people have been interested in, but because of the way the laws are designed in Indiana, just doesn't allow for that. And then a whole host of other things that on bills that may be filed but not get heard. Most folks probably don't realize that you'll read in the paper or hear on the radio that, in fact, some bill has been filed, and folks might be thinking, what are they thinking? Well, that doesn't mean that the bill is going to go anywhere. Any bill can be filed. It doesn't mean it'll get a hearing and go any further than that.
Right, I see. Let's just take up kind of a list of some of the topics we know that are of interest, certainly, and what might turn into some bills. Somebody will pull, no doubt, take it up as a topic and file something on it in time. Let's talk here a little bit first here about education, in particular about public schools. And I know that there are a number of things that may be discussed this time around. One of the things I understand that may possibly come up is how big a school district should be.
Right. Well, I'm not on the education committee, so I don't know specifically what their priorities will be, but mm-hmm. The problem that we see is that there's so many dollars going toward administration of schools rather than necessarily getting to the classroom, and so there's talk about trying to provide incentives in some way to encourage a little consolidation there. It's not so much the case in our area, because we have fairly good-sized school districts as a rule, but we have lots of rural school districts that really struggle with this.
I can imagine they probably, in some places out, not necessarily in your district, of course, since it's urban, but I know in some of your colleagues, even South Lake County, you know, you get out there in some of the communities out that way, and they have rural school districts, they have to deal with that as well, too.
Well, and the biggest problem, that is all correct, but Chris, but the biggest concern is a slow reduction in school population. You'll hear administrators and teachers complain about the fact that they're not getting as much money as they used to, which on one side is true, on the other side it's not. We keep raising the amount of dollars per students, but when you consider the fact that in many school districts, even mine in Lake Central, mm-hmm. they're seeing a somewhat of a decline in school population, which means that's about $6,000 per student they're not receiving. So if they're down 100 students, that's a lot of dollars. And in the rural areas, that's especially the case when they're operating on a small budget, not just thin, but small in and of itself, because they only have 1,000, 1,500 students. They lose 20 students, they really feel it.
Now, we're talking with State Representative Hal Slager, who's Republican here in Lake County, and some of the issues that are likely to come up as the General Assembly gets underway for another short session here very soon. I know one topic I'm sure is going to have to come up, it's been discussed already, is dealing with the opioid crisis, not only here in Northwest Indiana, but elsewhere in Indiana. Tell us what you might see may possibly be discussed during the session.
Right. Well, and it's not just all of Indiana. It's all over the country. We seem to have a real problem with it. In the last couple of sessions, we've been working on this where we've restricted the amount that doctors can prescribe to 7 days because we have a real problem with pilfering where we have, you know, people stealing drugs out of medicine cabinets, and of course they're prescription drugs, and people get hooked on them, and then when the prescription's out or when the doctor quits writing them, they've got to find an alternate. And I know the medical community has become very much aware of this, but we've put a number of mechanisms in place, and the real focus this last year was not on penalizing people, but helping them recover and get past this so that they can move on with their life. And I expect we'll see many more of those types of bills in this next session.
Now, you kind of mentioned here at the start of our conversation here about the possibility that we might see something come up involving a Sunday liquor sales of some sort. We know that they've already had some discussions, I guess, at study committee in the recent months here about this. So you think something will shape up in some kind of report from this study committee that lawmakers may actually look at as in some form of a bill this session coming up?
I really do. The problem that we face when we're changing the rules of the game, if you will, and we've got these liquor laws that have been around for decades or longer, and people have built businesses around those rules, for better or worse. And when you start changing the rules, you're going to have winners and losers. That's the most difficult part of our job is when we're put into that position. And there are the different factions that have very different opinions. Liquor store owners don't want to be open on Sundays, and the big retailers with lots of floor space don't want that to be dead space for a day. And so I think what we've done, we've made it pretty clear last year that we're going to have to deal with this. And I always tell people if you just allow the legislature to do it their way, you're guaranteed to be unhappy. So I've seen the different factions here trying to come together to come up with something that is more agreeable than if we just do it on our own. And so I do anticipate we're going to get there to some degree. Now, we have lots of liquor laws besides Sunday sales that need to be addressed. And I don't know how much of that we're going to get into in this session, but I do believe we're going to see some real movement on Sunday sales.
One other topic I know is more national, like the opioid crisis that we're dealing with is the issue of immigration. We know that we have cities that have become welcoming cities, in particular here in Lake County and the like. Do you think that maybe that some discussion is going to come up during the session, even though there's not a lot of time to talk about it, about the issue of DACA in particular, and that's an issue we know that Congress is trying to work out right now, but something that the Hoosier legislators may be able to talk about?
Well, this is a difficult situation because Congress won't act, and for several years our federal government really hasn't been enforcing the laws like they should. And so now we're in a situation that's unfortunate where we have, in effect, allowed lots of people to enter this country illegally. And because they're not legal citizens, they don't have the rights that legal citizens do. And I just see us being in a position where we're creating citizens that may young citizens that may be just angry citizens,
right.
And that's no good either. In particular, the one issue that I keep hearing rolling around, and in fact I've even put it out on my next survey, is as it relates to these young people that have gotten good grades, they've been in school and not gotten into trouble, and in every respect they act like good citizens. They're just technically not citizens because they were brought here at a very young age, the DACA situation you talked about, and whether that or not they should receive in-state tuition rates if they go to college. Again, this falls under the heading of what kind of citizens do we want to deal with. I absolutely believe that you need to come into this country legally. But at some point, we've got to face the reality. We've got an awful lot of illegal folks in this country, and how do we want to handle this in a reasonable manner?
I see. One other topic, too, I know that has been brought up by some other comments here in the past here is related and is more of a national issue, but has certainly been discussed here in Indiana, is the issue of hate crimes. Do you think there might be some discussion in the General Assembly, the session, about that?
I do. Most people don't realize that our code already accounts for special circumstances such as this. It's just not explicitly stated. So I think at some point in time, we're just, in order to move the conversation, we're going to have to deal with this at some level. So I might expect to see something there as well.
And, of course, not only do we have these issues that have come up here, they'll be discussed, no doubt, we have another set of elections, the 2018 elections, the primaries, and, of course, the general election in November. Do you think there might be any discussions about that? And I know that you have brought up in the past as well here in Northwest Indiana about dealing of with redistricting as well, too. Do you think any of this is going to resurface in the session?
I really don't know on some of these and how much time we're going to have. You have to remember we only have 10 weeks, and so it's we've got about 3 weeks for each house to hear the first set of bills, and then a few days break, and then back for another 3-4 weeks for the next round to hear the other house's bills, and then we go into conference committee. So just how much we get to is uncertain.
I see. Well, let me ask you now, are there any particular bills or topics that you're going to bring up when you get your chance to do so in Indianapolis this session?
Well, we have a couple of things that are again, cleanups from prior years that we're going to see. I've had, interestingly, a number of people come to me with ideas, but unfortunately we're past the drafting deadline, so if we do something, it would have to, for those folks, it'd probably have to be in the form of an amendment. One of them, of course, is should we be paying elected officials who are incarcerated? This is a real question mark.
We have some situations as we speak about dealing with these things too. Yeah, so I imagine that they probably other lawmakers across the state that you meet with in Indianapolis probably bring the subject up, or if they haven't, they will, I'm sure.
Right. The other thing that I'm working on, and I don't have any expectation it's actually going to get a vote this time. Good bills usually take some time to develop, and one of them we're seeing is there's a couple of municipalities or government units that are struggling, much like we saw with the Gary School Corporation. And in their case, we were writing them checks and giving them loans for some years before we finally had the DUAB come in, the Distress Unit Appeals Board, and then ultimately taking over the district, which, by the way, nobody wanted to do. And we need to, number one, do everything we can to avoid that in the future, as well as put some hooks in place that those entities realize if the state's going to come in and provide assistance, what are our expectations going to be in managing that? And so last year I had a bill where the state examiner's findings could actually go somewhere. Before, he'd write a report and it had no teeth. Now he can take it to a higher level if those issues are not addressed when he comes back the next year. A follow-up to that would be what kind of spending controls would be put in place in the event that we provided state assistance. So that's the next bill I'm looking at developing to deal with that before it becomes personal, before we're talking about a specific government unit or municipality or school district, whatever it may be. we can deal with that kind of generically so that everybody knows what the rules will be going forward.
State Representative Hal Slager is Republican. He has this House District number 15, which includes communities of Dyer and Schererville and St. John Township, and he's also had portions of St. John and Griffith in his district as well, too. Thank you very much for being with us. A lot of things to talk about and a lot of things that will, I'm sure, come up and for discussion, at least get kicked around, at least in discussion in Indianapolis here, whether it actually turns into a bill and whether it actually, I guess, goes through the process. We'll just have to wait and see about that. Thank you for spending, though, some time with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
Indeed, Chris. Thanks for calling, and call me anytime.
Design technology students at the Ivy Tech Community College over in Valparaiso have helped come up with a 3D model of a car park for none other than famous TV celebrity Jay Leno. And for that, we find out more from Jason Gordon, head of the department of the design technology program there at Ivy Tech in Valparaiso. And Jason, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris.
And we're being joined as well, too, by Susan Perry, who is the Dean of Technology for Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, Valentina Petruski, who is a member of the program and a member of the team that helped work on this part. Thank you both to you, Susan, and to Valentina for being with us as well.
Design technology is it's a wonderful growing field right now. It's really the language of technology. We teach all kinds of software programs here, AutoCAD and SolidWorks and Revit, BIM, all kinds of stuff like that, and we're actually venturing into Fusion starting next year. So we're really excited. We have a lot of employers calling us at this time, and we're doing all kinds of interesting things with architecture and graphic design, and in our case here with the Jay Leno part, mechanical design, mm-hmm. using our new 3D printer, a Strata system printer that's state-of-the-art.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about this part. It's a 1929 Duesenberg that Jay Leno owns. How did he end up having to have this part in the first place?
Well, I read on the I read that he's actually got a few 3D printers himself, but they're not the top of the line printers. And I thought, you know, this would be a wonderful project for our students to get involved in. A lot of them are, of course, fans of his show, and he was looking. I contacted his agent. He actually gave me a call back, which really surprised me. And he had mentioned that he really likes to help schools and education, and that's a passion of his. So he wanted to help us, and I got a call from his mechanic the next day, and they sent a STL file to us, and we were able to print it later that week.
That's great. That's great. What is the difference that you've noted in being able to create a car part by the 3D printer as compared to, say, you know, taking that part, putting it in a sand mold and casting something out of metal from it?
Well, often what will happen is that you print the 3D part first, and then you may do a casting after that. There's times where the parts don't exist anymore. Or you may have a part that has been scanned that's damaged, and we can digitally reproduce that and correct the problem. Say there's a dent in the part or part of it is missing. We can correct that, 3D print it, and then it can be cast.
Richard Morose is a member of the staff there at Ivy Tech Valparaiso, and he's an instructor in the class involving robotics. Rich, if you will, tell us a little bit about the 3D printer that was used to make this part for Jay Leno for his Duesenberg.
Well, this 3D printer works similar to an inkjet printer. It has several nozzles. It uses a liquid resin that's ejected from these nozzles, and it does several passes. And then it's cured by a UV light. Each layer is cured by a UV light, and as the part is built from the bottom up. And then it's basically that's it. I mean, it works different than other 3D printers. It's more precise and it's more detailed.
Mm-hmm. 5 thou, it'll be as precise as 5 thou of an inch, which is basically
wow.
the spec for machining with a CNC machine.
Uh-huh. Now, is this part now stronger than something either the original part that might have been made for the original Duesenberg, or even for that matter a remanufactured part? That, you know, like I said, if you try to cast something or with some other material, is this new part made by the 3D printer stronger than the original?
Well, we have several materials we can make this part out of.
Mm-hmm.
There's 12 different materials that this printer can print. Basically, this part could be used. It's strong enough to use on a car, but it's strictly, he was going to use it to cast a one out of brass, I believe it was,
right,
and then have it chromed or whatever he was going to
mm-hmm.
do.
Right. I see.
But what you might find interesting is that this 3D printer doesn't just do a poly, it'll also do a rubberized material, and we'll do clear material. A matter of fact, the part we printed was a clear material, and which can have all kinds of great applications. We also did a Harley-Davidson engine, didn't we, Richard?
It was a lawnmower engine.
Oh, it was a lawnmower engine?
Where
you can see the parts moving on the inside,
yeah,
because
uh-huh.
it's a clear material.
Well, it sounds like it would be great for instructional purposes that you can you know, as far as trying to teach somebody how an internal combustion engine works, you know, something like the old days when toys were made out of plastic to see the working parts of a machine.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, today we're printing for our medical area here at Ivy Tech. We're printing an MRI version of a human brain. So that's made of a rubberized material, and so that our students over in nursing can look at it and study it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you should note that. Let's bring Susan Perry, the Dean of Technology there at Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, in on the conversation. Now, Susan, when you hear and learn about these things that the Design Technology Program has been doing, how does this fit into the overall mission of the department?
Oh, it just fits in perfectly, Chris. We're so happy to have this opportunity. And when Jason told me that he received a message from Jay Leno, it's like, wow, that's really quite awesome. The thing that we emphasize in all of our classes is that hands-on experience, Chris. And we have the theory, of course, but every class in design, as well as our technology programs, are very, very hands-on. And we look for those real-life opportunities wherever we can. So this was a perfect fit with what kind of experience we like our students to have when they leave here.
Well, now, Jason, now that this part's been taken care of, it's been created by the 3D printer and sent off to Jay Leno's Big Dog Garage out there in Burbank, California. Any response back from the folks out at California about how the part seems to fit in into what Jay Leno had hoped to have done on the vehicle?
Actually, they called me back the next day after they received it, and they were ecstatic. And it looks like they may give us some more parts. So we're pretty excited about that. And we're grateful that they did that. We think that we're trying to open up this printer to industry, especially here in Indiana. So if there's any companies out there that would like to work with us, we'd really be happy to do that. And, of course, any students that are interested, please give us a call. Classes start up in the spring, so we'd love to have you. And it's an exciting field. Think about it. You can almost replicate anything. As long as we have a scanner, we can almost replicate anything. So it's an exciting field right now. And I hope we can work with Jay again. Richard and I were tossing up who was going to drive this part down to California, but unfortunately, we had classes and we had to mail it.
Oh, too bad. Well, maybe if you get more business from the Big Dog Garage for other vehicles that Jay Leno or some other people that have vehicles in the garage that have to be worked on and need to be replaced, maybe you'll get some other business and they'll give you that opportunity to be able to drive out to Burbank, California and deliver it in person.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd like to drive one of his Stanley Steamers, actually.
That's true. You get a chance if you go out to the garage, you get to see his fleet that's out there parked in the area out there too. It'll be great to see that as well too. Valentina, as far as working with the students are concerned on this project, what kind of reaction did the students have about having an opportunity to do a little robotics work as well as actually see something made and actually turn into something that somebody will use?
Actually, they are so excited. Students are always excited about projects when they can use some critical thinking skills and do the hands-on, you know, project-based learning, and they just getting so engaged. You know, they form in teams, and it just works so well for them, and it's a great thing they can put in their resume and get a better internship or a job opportunity. Just so, so exciting for them. I think students were more excited than the instructors.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, that might, it might be a toss-up on that, too. But it's also good to know, too, that you know that, that it'll, the word will get around among the students that if they're interested in taking this class here for this next year coming up, that they'll get involved in making more projects as well, too. It'd be interesting to see what does come about it here. We've been talking with Valentina Petrushki, as well as with instructor Richard Moroche, and with the Dean of Technology at Ivy Tech Community College, Valparaiso Campus, Susan Perry, and Jason Gordon, who is the chairman of the Design Technology Program. It's been the program that has been very involved in creating a 3D model of a car part for Jay Leno to be able to use in one of his fleet of the beautiful antique vehicles that he has at the Big Dog Garage out in Burbank, California. And thank you all for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about this and hope to get more word of more great parts, not only for Jay Leno, but for other people as well, too, that are made there at the Ivy Tech Community College campus in Valparaiso.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris.
And now another Lakeshore-focused conversation from Lakeshore PBS.
I'm a fan of those old Western movies that many of us watched as kids. Didn't you love the line, "There's a new sheriff in town"? Back then, a sheriff stood for law and order, courage and toughness, wisdom and integrity. Real life is not like the movies, and sometimes a law enforcement official does not match those standards, but on today's show, we have one of these sheriffs who matches the previous description, or at least he tries to live up to it. Let's welcome Dave Reynolds, the sheriff of Porter County, Indiana.
Thank you, Keith.
Glad to have you on the show.
Right. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah. So this is kind of your second time around as being sheriff. You were sheriff for 8 years.
Yes.
And then you took a break?
Took a break for 8 years, worked for a private consultant for primarily U.S. Steel, and kind of got talked back into running again. Didn't think I was going to, but I'm really glad I did, and I'm glad to be back. So this is my third term.
So what was it like when you kind of made the decision to jump back in? Because I know you had kind of said, probably not going to do it again, but what'd they say to talk you into it?
Well, it was the first time I was the police chief from Portage when I ran, and it was a lot different. And, you know, times change, and most of the officers on the department I had hired and was very familiar with, so they were contacting me. So I think that had a lot to do with my decision, that they actually wanted me to come back. And but it was a big decision. You know, you have to talk to your family and talk to all of your people around you and try to make the right decision for everyone concerned. But after I made the decision, you know, being the sheriff is difficult, but the actual process of getting there is something that people overlook. Just the election process it's taxing, and it really impacts your whole family and everyone around you, and you need help.
Yeah. Well, you had such a good reputation, I think, first time around, that probably helped a whole lot when it came back to the second time. So maybe some of the taxpayers might want to know, was there any savings at all? I mean, were you able to use the same uniforms or same business cards or anything?
Not too much. I think I did have some of the old uniforms, but it was pretty much start from over, you know, start from scratch.
I just thought about that today. I thought, I wonder if there was anything that was still laying around left over from the previous regime. So it's kind of interesting. So how different does it feel today in this role versus 10 years ago?
That's a good question. I think the biggest thing I've seen is the impact of drugs that have had it not only in our society, but in the police department. We've always had a drug issue. I think people are starting to understand that most crime is directly associated with drug abuse. And it's always been that way. I mean, I first became a law enforcement, got in law enforcement in the early 70s and worked in a drug unit. So it was a problem even back then, but I don't think it impacted how we do our job, how everybody does our job, and how it affects the day-to-day living. Most of the crimes that what you see in the paper, if you just look in the paper, all your thefts, your burglaries, your armed robberies, almost everything is directly associated to substance abuse. And I think that's changed quite a bit from the last time.
Now, I want to make sure I clarify something, because it sounded almost like you have an internal drug problem at the police station.
No, but it's what we do. Our law enforcement, right. Our guys every day, you know, they work traffic. But outside of traffic, the calls that they respond to, their job is directly related to substance abuse.
It's just had a big impact
on what they do.
So are you saying the drug problem is significantly worse than 10 years ago?
Without question.
Okay, I mean, give us some, is it twice as bad, three times as bad?
I would say it's I don't know what kind of numbers you can put on it, but I would say it's 10, 20, I mean, it's not even close. And the big reason is the impact of heroin. We had heroin back, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Even when I was first elected, it was a problem. But it's off the charts now, because we have young adults throughout our whole county going to Chicago every day buying heroin. And really what the game changer has been about 2 years ago is the emergence of fentanyl. And fentanyl is a synthetic opium that they use for a cutting agent with the heroin. And why that's so significant is fentanyl is 50 to 75 times stronger than pure heroin. So that is the reason we're having all our overdoses. And so it's really impacted everything.
Is it also cheaper to buy now?
Oh, without question. It's cheaper and it's stronger. Just to give you an idea, when I was working in undercover buying heroin as an undercover agent, the percentage of heroin back then in the early 70s, in the early 80s, was 6-7% pure. So that's 94% that wasn't heroin, it was just a cutting agent. Now for the same amount of money, 30 years later, it's 75-95% pure, but they're cutting it with fentanyl. So that's not even, that's why consequently we're having so many overdoses. We never had the overdoses back then that we have now. And it's largely attributed to the fact that of the fentanyl. And they're actually selling pure fentanyl. So there's no question, there's the reason why people are overdosing.
So how have you changed what the officers do, or how do the officers deal with this differently, or right. How's your leadership shaped what you have to do today?
That's an excellent question.
I'm trying to ask good ones.
What we've done, because we knew we had to do, we have to do something different. And what we created was a HORT team, a heroin overdose response team. So it's HORT. And those are police officers. Those aren't undercover officers. They're not detectives. They're police officers. Because now everyone has naloxone, which is, that's the agent that they have, they carry with them to try to use at an overdose scene. So they can use that and administer that to the victim that's overdosed to try to bring them back. But if they bring them back, what we've changed is that there's a lot of departments. Now everyone's changing their philosophy on how to deal with this. But the theory was a lot of departments looked at an overdose as a medical condition. Well, somebody's overdosed. So they would call an ambulance, bring them out, take them to the hospital, and that's it. They would maybe make a short report. Well, now we're investigating it as a crime scene. Because if the person overdosed on heroin, we are now, and if we revive them and bring them back, we interview them and we try to get information before they're actually taken to the hospital. Or if they're at the hospital, the officers will go to the hospital and then basically investigate that case as a crime scene.
So what's the crime?
Well, the crime is that they had heroin and they've used the heroin, which is illegal, and the heroin's in their system, or they have the needle. In most cases, the needle's right there, so the heroin's in the needle, so you have possession of needles, which is illegal, and oftentimes you have drugs present, so we get search warrants, and we search the house, or however, whatever needs to be done at the scene. So that's what's changed, and now we try to get that information. The whole objective here is trying to identify the dealers that are bringing, that these people are using in Porter County, the users. We're not really focused on the users so much of arresting them. We're trying to get use the users, the information that they may provide to try to find out where their source is. And it's a difficult process. I mean, it's not easy because the dealers are not in Porter County.
Right.
A lot of them are in Lake County, but most of them are in Chicago. So what do we do? In the past, we just said, well, they're in Chicago. There's nothing we can do. But what we've done now is that we've assigned an officer from our department to work with the strike force with DEA in Chicago. So now we're trying to cut off the head, not the tail. Because I think in the past, the drug units were more focused on numbers. And the average person, like yourself, if I told you, hey, we arrested 500 people last year, or maybe I told you we arrested 250 people, what does that actually mean? You wouldn't know, and I don't know what that means either. But if I told you, hey, we're identifying the dealers in Chicago on the south side and southwest side of Chicago, and we're trying to make a difference by cutting off the head, and a lot of these dealers are major dealers are in Lake County. Well, what we've done now is because of the Hort team and the intelligence that we're getting, we're working together now, which was never been done before, with all the undercover agents working together. It's been very effective.
Let me probe a little deeper on this because, I mean, we're talking about the supplies there, it's cheap to buy, and I mean, obviously people get addicted to these kind of things. But, you know, for a lot of crime and just things you have to deal, how do you see, what's the root of some of these problems in our society? I mean,
what causes
this
it
is,
all?
Yeah, this is kind of the result, you know, of things going on. I mean, why are these specific people using drugs? Why are they turn to this? Why do they turn to crime?
Well, I think that's a good question. I don't know if it has a very simple answer to it.
It probably doesn't have a simple answer.
Our approach to the problem is law enforcement, which I've explained what we're doing. Second thing is that we've really increased our because I am the sheriff and I oversee this jail. We've increased our programs, our treatment programs in a jail. We've got more programs in our jail than any jail in the state, maybe in the Midwest. We've just introduced a program called a Vivitrol program. So when you're an addict and you're being released with a court order and everyone agreeing to it, the probation pact, the public defenders, they can be administered a shot that blocks the craving for the opiate. And so we've started that about 2 weeks ago, and we're encouraged with that, trying to, you know, because basically what that does is it's going to mandate these people coming out, leaving our jail to seek treatment. And if they don't seek treatment through the Vivitrol program with the mental health facility, then they're going to come back to jail. So our ultimate goal there is trying to, when they get out, and we tell them this, our goal is for you not to come back. And because if they don't come back and they don't commit crimes, we're all safer. And so that's the second thing. But the answer, I think getting closer to the answer, is what we think is, we think treatment's very important. I believe that, but it's not the answer. Law enforcement is very important, obviously, but it's not the answer. We can't out-arrest ourselves out of this problem. But the answer is, what causes it? How do we turn it around? It's an education and prevention. So what do you do with that? What we've done is we created a video, and we have the inmates in the video. It's a heroin, it's not a problem, it's an epidemic. And we've now produced our second video, which will be out in about 2 weeks. And our purpose there is to reach the fifth graders on up. Yeah, all high school, parents. We're focusing this time a little bit more on parents and grandparents so they can be accountable and somewhat take some responsibility to the problem. Because when we interview all these inmates in their graduations, we're seeing that when they were first introduced to drugs, it wasn't like people think of these drug parties. Most of these inmates say that they were first introduced to drugs from their family, their parents. So that's a problem. You know, how do you turn that around?
So you got to get back into the deal. I think it's really interesting how you analyze this, because if you really look at it, law enforcement is a response to this problem. It's like it's kind of at the end of it, like we got to do something about this. And the treatment is trying to get a person back kind of right. to square one. But you're saying the root is really go back to educate people and to, right. to try to. So you must be doing some things in the schools then more.
Without
sounds
question.
Like.
We're taking this video because we believe it's not totally responsible, the reason for it, but there's a breakdown in the families. A lot of these people that are involved in drugs, and don't get me wrong, there's some addicts that have come from great families. They've given them everything. Maybe they gave them too much. And maybe there's no answer why certain kids go one way, and there are some kids from bad families that turn out really good.
Can you really get to the families? I mean,
well, I think what we try to do is when we show the video, we're trying to get to these kids. I really don't think we can. I think what we have to do is that we have to empower these fifth graders, sixth graders, that you're gonna have to make decisions, the right decisions. And even though you're exposed to it, maybe from family, friends, to temptations or whatever, that you're gonna have to make the right decision. And it's tough, you know. It's tough that you have that. It happens that way.
Well, what's kind of the content a little bit of the video? Because I think some of the research says the scared straight thing doesn't really quite work. Just
right.
to scare young people to death doesn't really work. So what is the video saying, or what's the message it's saying?
It's interesting you said that, because when we first did the video and we just were producing it, we didn't know how to classify it. Is this a scared straight video, I was at a conference, and they came out and said the same thing. Boot camps don't work, scared straight doesn't work. And I'm thinking, gee, we just spent a lot of time and effort in this video.
For years, right.
And we showed them the video, and they go, well, this isn't really a scared straight video. What this is an educational reality video. Because what we've done on their first video is we interviewed a few family parents who have lost their loved ones, and they give their story. And then we interviewed about 15 or 20 inmates. Some of them gave their stories. Some just said, hey, I'm John Doe, and I'm 16 years old. I was 16 years old when I tried heroin. I live in Portage. I live in Hebron. I live in Couts. And what we were trying to do, and these guys were all in jail. So what we tried to do is impress upon the viewer that all of these guys and girls that were in jail all came from Porter County, all from different parts of the county, and they're all in our jail because they made bad decisions. So at some point in time, you're going to have to make the right decision. Then the second video, we've re-interviewed most of the people that were in the first video. Got a few more different families. You can make an argument that it's kind of scared straight. We threw a few more photographs in of people that have overdosed. But my opinion is that I'm trying to make an impression on a fifth grader, a junior high student.
So how do you get these into the schools then?
Oh, they invite us in.
The schools are very receptive doing this.
Every school.
Does an officer go with this to present?
I do most of them. The coroner right now, Chuck Harris, he goes to. We have our public information officer has done it. I mean, if they call, it could be like with Valparaiso school system, I came in and did every seventh grader and every eighth grader. So all the seventh graders came in.
They all know who you are now, right?
Showed them the video, showed them. And you know, there was a lot of discussion on, well, fifth grade might be too young. So what we did was we started with eighth grade. We started high school. Good response. High school didn't have a lot of response. But eighth grade talked a lot. It was better. Seventh grade was better than with the eighth. As we got younger, it got better, I thought. And when we got down to the sixth and fifth graders, they were you could tell it was making an impact on them. And I think it's not the panacea, and I don't think it's the answer. But I think it was done because we talked to those kids, those students, those young adults, just like I would if I was talking to their parents. And I think if you talk to them like adults and you tell them that this is a problem we have in our society today that you need to understand, you're going to see this. Somebody's going to approach you and offer you some drugs. And then when they see it in the video, when we're at one particular school, and I'll say, hey, you remember that second guy? He sat in the same gym. He's from this school. He sat in the same gym, and he got good grades when he was in 7th and 8th grade. And look where he's at
now.
That
makes a huge impact on people.
Right, and they listened.
Let me ask you, you know, the sheriff's position as an elected official is really a very powerful position. What do you feel like is the most important aspect of your job? The couple things like, as a sheriff, my duty or my big part of my job is to do what?
I think it's to be available. I think it's to be responsive to whatever county. If you ask, there's 92 counties, 92 sheriffs. Every sheriff has probably their own issues and own different challenges and different problems. And Porter County has, you know, we have our own too. And I think just by being asked to be on a show, I think it's my responsibility to come and explain to not only the constituents, but the people in your county or surrounding counties of what we're doing and how we're trying to challenge, dealing with our challenges. And I think it's important. I mean, if you just sat in your office and kind of thought you moved papers around every day and you really didn't get out in the community, I think you're doing yourself a disservice to the people that elected you.
How often are you in your office? Sounds like you're out a lot.
I'm out a lot, but it's busy. But I'm not a micromanager. I mean, I've kind of been at this for a long time, and you just have a different style, and I believe that you point people, put people in your positions, and allow them to do their job. And if they have a situation, a question, or problems come up, then that's when they're supposed to get a hold of you. And I think that's why we work as well as we do, because as a sheriff, people need to understand I'm in charge of the jail, so I have a lot. I have a tremendous staff. I'm also have a police department, but I'm also in charge of the courts too. And so you have officers in the courts, and my job is to protect the courts and the judges. And so I need to make sure I have people in those right spots.
Sheriff is a big job. There's no doubt about it. That's why I was kind of curious what was kind of at the top of the list, because I know the list is very long for what you're doing. We're down to a couple minutes, and I guess in the last couple minutes, what do you feel like, besides what we've already talked about, you've really had an impact on? Your leadership has had an impact in doing something you're kind of proud of.
Well, I'm really proud of how we're tackling the opiate problem, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to say it briefly. We've really, this is my third time around, and one of the things I really wanted to work on was school safety, and we've developed a one county, one protocol right now. So we've got all 77 schools, public and private, even daycare centers, YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, all on the same protocol on how to deal with an emergency situation, primarily an active shooter. And so I'm really proud of that. We actually created a video on that. Anybody can go onto our website and just put in active shooter Porter County and you'll see the video. And we use that as an educational tool. We are on October 26th, we're going to do a tabletop with all first responders and educators. We're going to have a scenario because I'm really proud of the fact that we've got everybody working together, trying to, with our ultimate goal of keeping our kids in school safe. Because I believe that kids should go to school and learn, and they shouldn't have to worry about all of the bad things that are happening. And unfortunately, when you have problems, drug problems or domestic violence problems that you mentioned earlier, everybody thinks it's the responsibility of the teachers. You know, but the teachers are supposed to teach. You know, I think we all need to, as a community, need to take part of what the problems are.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your leadership, and I tell you, I live in Porter County, so I feel safe knowing that you're our sheriff.
Thank you.
I'm really glad you came to the show and shared your thoughts. So.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking me to be here today.
You bet. Thanks, Dave.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and is rebroadcast on Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. Money plays a big role in the development of renewable energy projects, and right now, solar energy faces two big challenges in Indiana that could make solar more expensive for some Hoosiers. We find out in this from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen.
The first thing that worries solar advocates is the possibility of a tariff. That's like a tax we pay on things imported from overseas, in this case, solar panels. Earlier this year, two companies asked the U.S. International Trade Commission to put a tariff on foreign-made solar panels. The companies say low-cost Chinese-made panels in particular put them at a disadvantage, and a tariff will bolster American-made panels.
It's a really technical issue.
State Representative Dave Ober chairs the House Utility and Energy Committee.
If the president decides to enact tariffs on imported panels for solar systems, that cost gets passed on to consumers, and it eats away a lot of the price drop that we've seen over the past 10 years or so.
And if panels are more expensive, then installing solar systems becomes more expensive too. The Solar Energy Industries Association says tariffs could cost 88,000 jobs nationwide. Citizens Action Coalition Director Kerwin Olson says that would be a shame because right now, solar jobs are growing faster than any other.
It would have a significant impact. We would lose jobs in the solar industry as a whole. We may pick up some in solar manufacturing, but that would not be enough to offset the job loss that would come as a result of people canceling solar installation jobs because of increased costs.
Some Indiana companies do manufacture parts for solar systems, but most work on the installation side. Many of these same companies testified against a controversial state energy bill passed last spring that, in part, reduces incentives for rooftop solar systems, Indiana Senate Bill 309.
All of the evidence in the marketplace is showing 309 made no sense, that we would be building a wall around us, isolating us in the context of where future job growth is coming in the energy industry.
Ironically, many solar installers say the bill helped business as customers rush to install systems before the full incentives go away at the end of the year. But they don't expect that boom to last. And while many acknowledge the bill is harmful to the rooftop solar industry, there is a provision in it that cuts red tape for larger solar projects, says Indiana Energy Association President Mark Mazel.
What we're going to see is people installing what makes sense to them. So I think what we're talking about is creating options for customers.
Mazel says it's possible the bill paves the way for the state to produce more solar energy overall, even if less comes from rooftop solar. But critics still say the bill curbs options instead of creating them. Schools especially are installing more solar to reduce utility costs, and they say they need more time to profit from their investment. To that end, Rep. Dave Ober says he's drafting legislation to help.
Public entities are not as nimble as their private counterparts as far as being able to manage money and fiscal resources to do these projects. They need a little more time, a little more lead time. And so what the legislation simply will do is extend a grandfathering period.
The bill would grandfather schools for 20 years, which Ober says would give schools enough time to put money that would have gone to electric bills back into the classroom. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
The legislative session in 2018 begins on January 3rd, and President Trump is expected to make a decision on solar tariffs by January 26th. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll have from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Dan Carton and Mark Chase, as well as from the Herald Argus and News Dispatch, John Gard, and from the Chicago Reporter, Kaylin Bresla will be with us to talk about a great report on education and how people moving from Chicago into Northwest Indiana have to deal with the school system over here. May not be much different from the one they just left. We hope you'll join us for that tomorrow.